Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 89, recorded September 30th, 2010. Call the Electrician. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware. It's been another week. It's time to discuss PC components, hardware, sound cards. We're going to debate Intel scratch-off CPUs again. I'm Ryan Shrout, joined again by Patrick Norton. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, man. This has been an interesting week for hardware. Or at least it just feels like it. Anytime I can turn around and find out that my fabulous, oh my God, it's ridiculously fast SSD drive has just gotten its ass kicked by a factor of 8.
Yeah, that's a good sign, not for your hardware or your budget, but for technology in general.
Oh, man. If you have an email question, do us a favor. Email us Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. That's the email address. And I got to say, yeah, so Intel X25M kind of been the standard bearer for solid-state drive performance. There have been faster drives on the market, but OCZ is basically saying SATA sucks. The performance of current SSD drives can be grossly improved, and they have a 240-gigabyte solid-state drive, the OCZ IBIS high-speed data link, which is not just a drive. It's a new way to connect your PCI Express bus. Dude, how expensive is this going to be, and how desperately do I want this?
The answers are probably not good for you either way, for either question. They're going to be expensive, and let me rephrase that. They're going to be expensive for the low capacities because they have to build in the price of selling you the card plus the new kind of data connect that I'll talk about in a second. You know, when you build that into like a 100 gig card, you're looking at, I think the price is like $529. So you're only talking about like $5.29 per gig. That's pretty high even for SSD standards. If you get into the 360 gig model, or even the 240 gig model, which is the one that Alan tested, you're looking at like just over $3 per gigabyte, which is still fairly expensive for SSDs, but I'd say we're kind of in that $250 to $3 per gigabyte range right now. So it's
we're talking a mere power. What? $750 for a 240 gigabyte hard drive?
Yes, that is correct. We are talking about $750 for 240 gigs of storage. It sounds crazy. Sounds like we went back to the mid-90s.
It sounds crazy until you look at the performance, at least on the benchmarks. Because this is what was absolutely mind blowing. Is I was looking at some of the reviews where random writes were like, I want to say 4 to 5 times as fast as the. And obviously, I'm obsessing on the X25N because it's the drive I own. But like 4 to 5 times as fast, and I want to say 8 times as fast for sequential reads. I mean, is this a benchmark phenomenon, or can you actually feel how fast this thing is as you're ripping open files in your CD, cackling as you run around? Well, you don't really have time to run to get a sandwich.
Right.
Not off your CD, yeah. To put this into context, like, you know, you launch Windows 7, it takes like a minute to start, you kind of, you know, you clean up your desk or you pour yourself a drink or you go to the bathroom. You throw an SSD drive in a, you know, Core 2 or a Core i7 or now the, you know, i3, i5 systems. And all of a sudden, yep, Windows 7 boots in 15 seconds. Like, I'm not exaggerating. It is literally that fast. That's the kind of performance difference the slower and now outmoded solid state drives can deliver. Is this thing, at what point do hard drives get so fast it's kind of like graphics cards on 2D acceleration where it no longer matters because it can move stuff so fast your CPU or your eyeballs can no longer handle the pace?
Yeah, we're not there yet. I can tell you that much. even with something like this. So like the biggest performance delta we saw was in random writes, where this drive was able to get over 700 megabytes per second. The best standard SATA SSD is able to get like 220 megabytes per second.
Wow.
Now, writes are mostly important for like server environments and that kind of stuff. Your traditional user is not really writing a whole bunch of data to their drive all the time. You know, you're downloading files. Most of the time, what you want really fast stuff for as a consumer is reading. You know, getting that data, loading stuff up quickly, saving your Word document might not necessarily be as important to you. But even if we're talking about random reads, we're nearing 800 megabytes per second for random reads. And the way you kind of set it up really well at the beginning, the way they're able to do this is they decided that the SATA bus is old and antiquated and can't keep up with the technology behind solid state disks, the flash memory itself. And that's absolutely true. The move from SATA 3.0 gigabits per second to SATA 6.0 gigabits per second is useless for traditional spindle-based hard drives. We've seen it. There are spindle-based hard drives out there that support that interface, and they really see no kind of real-world benefit from it. SSDs could already saturate that. I mean, that's limited to, 500, 600 megabytes per second, and we're already seeing write speeds and read speeds above that with this technology. And what OCZ did was they basically took a high-speed data link standard that they basically created. It used it through existing standards, mini SAS connectors, and they basically have a card that plugs in to the PCI Express slot on your motherboard, and then that card connects to this very specific storage technology. It looks like a 3.5-inch hard drive, only it's all solid state inside of it, with actually, I guess, a couple of solid state drives technically running in a RAID 0 array.
They've effectively created an SSD RAID that fits in a 3.5-inch drive slot.
Correct. And the thing is they've done this before, but it was on a SATA 3.0 bus. And so it was kind of, they pegged that SATA 3 bus and it was like, well, okay, now what? What else can you do?
Then they got really pissed off because they knew they could go faster.
Right. And we'd had, and even beyond that, we had PCI Express based SSDs. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was a PCI Express card that you plugged in. OCZ had one called the Revo drive. And if you know, like Fusion.io, those companies, they created basically flash memory on a PCI Express card that you plugged into your system. And it was really, really fast. This takes another step by the potential for an interconnect that you could have one card plugged into multiple drives. You could have a card like this one is 4x PCIe bandwidth. You could have one 8x or 16x, depending on how much performance you actually need. So it's expandable. You know, when you plugged in your PCI Express card, it took up a slot and you got that one drive at it and that was it. Their idea here is let's expand this. We can sell you a 1 terabyte drive next year that will connect to the same interconnect, or we can sell you a card that you can connect 4 hard drives to of this same performance level at one time. And you're only taking up one slot in your computer. So it's kind of compelling for that reason. We're still further away from when it will actually be available than I want it to be. I would be surprised if we see this before the end of the year. You know, some of the samples that they sent out, I think only 4 samples were actually distributed. They're working, and you know, we tested it and it didn't seem to have any major problems or anything, so that's a good sign. Just whether or not they can manufacture this kind of quickly, reliably, and cheaply.
One last question before we move on to a very interesting conversation about GPUs. Is this going to be OCZ only? Is this going to be a proprietary spec, or is OCZ opening HDSL to all comers?
So they say they're opening HSDL to everybody.
HSDL,
right.
My bad.
To everybody. The question is whether or not anybody else will adapt it. It's an unfortunate consequence. Usually when somebody creates a standard, when a company creates a standard and they call it open, right, their competitors don't want to sign on and start making stuff with that proprietary standard because, you know, if it's perceived as being weak. It's perceived as, you know, oh, we're not as good as this other company, so we have to follow what they're doing. What I really would like to have seen is this standard be adopted by some third-party you know, IEEE organization.
The HSDL Association. The HSDL Consortium, the HDSL Working Group, the HDSL. And I totally see what you're saying. The other thing, it's like the whole Blu-ray, it goes back to kind of like the Blu-ray HD DVD. It's like, well, do they really think Blu-ray is better, or do they just not want to pay royalties to somebody else?
Yeah. Now, what their goal is to see not only other storage companies to, adapt this interface, but also to see this interface built onto motherboards. So you don't even have to have the add-in card anymore. So you have, you know, you have your six SATA ports, and maybe you have two HSDL ports on your motherboard as well that then can connect to these high-performance solid-state drives. So that's the goal. We don't know if they'll reach it, but that's the goal.
It's a nice goal. 2011, we're going to be watching for that one. You are kind of sad and possibly despondent about the GPU market. AMD is slipping on releases of some of the higher 6000 series cards. Are you bumming, dude? Are GPUs over? Do I sense pain and frustration?
No, I tell you what. Honestly, when I read this story, my first thought was, good, I needed a break from testing things. The rumors going around were that cards were going to launch in the middle of October from AMD on their 6000 series. So this would be their upcoming generation. The idea was that their mid-range parts were going to launch first, kind of the, I guess, the 6700 series of cards. And then another story came out just this week from Digitimes, which is based in Taiwan. They have a lot of connections with these types of things. They say now that's going to be pushed back until November, which I think is not. I don't think it's going to cause a big problem. They're still going to beat the holiday rush. They might miss out on some of the really, really early purchases. And I don't think a month or a month and a half is really going to cause them to lose any ground to NVIDIA in terms of this area, because NVIDIA was so far behind introducing their first generation DX11 part that even if they were able to move up a few months, we're still January, February, March before we see the next generation of part from NVIDIA. So, you know, for people who are maybe thinking about holding off on a graphics card purchase today because of the 6000 series was going to be launched on October 12th, now you're going to have to wait maybe two more weeks, maybe six more weeks for that to actually happen. It's the never-ending cycle of internet, or of internet, of computer upgrade cycles, right? It's like, whenever you buy something, the new thing will always come out immediately after. The Leo effect, as it's often been called, especially with Apple products, right? So
I always want Leo to buy something before I buy it, so I know that there's going to be a really good price drop on it between when he buys it and when I do. So basically, if you're dying for the latest and greatest top of the line graphics card or a discount on a lower graphics card, hopefully it'll be safe to purchase by mid November.
Right.
Okay. We can do that.
All right. We're going to jump into some emails. We got a lot of good emails in this week, and we got several. I probably got about a dozen responses asking for feedback on the Intel scratch-off CPUs we talked about last week. We'll go through a few of those. Before we do that, I'll go ahead and jump in here and thank today's sponsor. That would be Carbonite Pro. Business PCs crash all of the time. These days, it's mostly because of hard drive failures, viruses, employees who are less selective than they should be about what they download on their PCs. Now, you can be sure to keep your business up and running, even if your computers aren't, with Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro backs up all the PCs on your business or for your business automatically whenever they're connected to the internet, which is obviously good. You want something that you don't have to go around from computer to computer. You don't have to micromanage if you don't want to. It's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer for maximum security. It's important for business, of course. It's easy to use, whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged techie. It's automatic. Carbonite backs up the files automatically whenever that computer is connected to the internet. And it's one account and one monthly bill. And with that one account, Carbonite Pro actually gives you a centralized dashboard to give you or your administrator a backup status summary of all the computers in your business so you can make sure all the PCs from your employees are updating as frequently as they should, which is good. If there ever is a data loss problem, Each employee can access their own backed up files themselves. You can be notified and your office can be back up and running with no headaches or time lost. And because your files are backed up off-site, each person can access their own files from any computer or even from their iPhone or BlackBerry with the free Carbonite applications. All this means you can focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. You can try this out free for 30 days. No offer code. All you have to do is go to CarbonitePro.com. Prices start as low as $10 a month. Like I said, you can try it completely free for 30 days and make sure it's the service that you want. I know I've used the consumer version of Carbonite Pro for a long time and have been very happy with it. Again, that URL is CarbonitePro.com. We thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Woohoo! Scratch off. Sorry, I was trying to correct the rundown because I moved something for us and then terrible things happened with Google Docs because nothing says pain like working in the cloud. Okay, so if you weren't listening last week, scratch off CPUs. Intel is offering a card you can buy at your favorite big box store so you can get a faster processor inside your PC by buying this card and then basically, you know, revealing a number and typing it in your BIOS or something like that, something irritating like that. Yeah, I don't know. I think we were both
kind of... Yeah, I think you have to go online and download a piece of software, but yeah, same idea.
It's the scratch and sniff CPU upgrade. And we solicited responses. Do you want to take Dylan's?
Yeah, so the first one says, it's from Dylan. Hi, Ryan and Patrick. As someone who builds PCs and servers for a living, I really liked the idea of CPU processors that you could unlock more power or cache or hyperthreading at a later time. It would allow me to help my clients spread out their expense and buy performance only after they grow into the equipment versus growing into hardware that is depreciating from day one. Or underbuying and having to replace because somebody calculated wrong. The items you were talking about weren't that far-reaching, but I can see the potential. Another element is with virtual machines, like VMware or Hypervisor. Since most licensing schemes are per socket, not per core, the ability to flick a switch and double the cores, add cache, and hyperthreading would be excellent. And finally, from a manufacturing standpoint, much easier on Intel, less variation in manufacturing, and the ability to have one physical box represent two or more potential SKUs cuts down inventory needs. Love the show. Keep up the good work.
We have a cool audience.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought about that for the server environment, right? It actually makes a lot of sense there that you can upgrade as you go. It's even you can do it remotely. Like you don't even have to have somebody go in there and like swap out a CPU, which costs engineering time and that kind of stuff.
And downtime.
It's always a lot of philosophical debates here, but let's get a couple more responses before we discuss it anymore. There's one from Charlie here.
Charlie says, Ryan and Patrick, there's one key piece of information I haven't heard yet to be able to say if I think this is a shady practice or not. I like saying shady practice. That makes me happy. Let's say one of these computers comes with a $100 CPU in it, but is gimped to run down like a $50 CPU. If that computer had been priced on the shelf as if it had a $50 processor in it, and your $50 upgrade card makes it run like a $100 processor, then I have absolutely no problem with this practice. I think y'all see where this is going. Realistically, I would expect more like a $35 or $40 for my $50 card, and that might be okay too. But my point is that I need to know what this $50 upgrade card actually buys you as compared to the price difference between two separate comparable chips. Thanks a lot. Love the show, Charlie. What is the value add?
Yeah, the only problem I have with his argument here is that when he says he doesn't like the idea of having a $100 CPU in the system that's gimped to run like a $50 CPU. And the reason I don't is because that's really what is happening all the time. If you buy, like when you bought your Core i7-920, Patrick, you know, that part could have probably have been a Core i7-970 or something like that, right? But they set it a different clock speed because they know their markets and what they can sell and what they can't. And they decided, well, rather than have this sit on the shelf as a Core i7-970, we'll sell it as a little bit cheaper, get some money out of it, and sell it as a Core i7-920. And that's the same general idea, right? They basically took a processor that was, quote, gimped from a 970 down to a 920 in theory, right? And they're doing the same thing. So it gets really kind of washy there.
I think what Joseph might have been saying is I don't mind paying $100 for a $100 CPU and getting a $100 CPU. Don't make me pay $100 for a $100 CPU. Give me $50 worth of performance and only let me have the other $50 worth of performance if I buy an extra $50 card on top of my $100 CPU that I already bought in the system. Therefore, making a $100 CPU a $150 CPU.
Right.
Although
I was just saying, I think that leads into the email that Joseph sent in, who's kind of on the other side of that. He says, I don't understand why people who are offended by this, they are selling you the chip as advertised. Before you would have had to pick between the two PCs and have no option of changing the fact after or changing it after the fact. Now you have that option, and few chips over time should lower costs for both Intel and consumer. He also had an interesting idea that if it benefits for a free trial, this would be where you could place the upgrade in effect for a limited portion, see if you see any benefit from it, and then you know it expires after 2 weeks or a month or something like that. And then if you want that performance back, you actually have to pay for it. I think that sounds like something Intel would never, ever do, but it's kind of an interesting idea. Like,
it's intriguing, though.
You know, how far can you take this? It's like, well, if you enabled hyper-threading, this is what it would be like. And you get to try that for 2 weeks and see if your gaming is different. That's why I think Intel wouldn't do it, is because I think a lot of users would enable it and go, I don't notice any difference.
Yeah, Halo isn't running any fat. Well, not that Halo runs on PCs anymore, but you know, it and it's true, right? Because you know, a 200%, you know, you wait 3 years to upgrade your PC or your notebook, you get like a 200% performance improvement. It smacks you in the face. It's obvious from startup to almost any activity you do that you've had a huge performance improvement. Usually going up a clock speed or a chip from like, you know, it's noticeable on the benchmarks. Ooh, it's 10%, but 10% performance is generally not noticeable anywhere other than in benchmarks.
Right.
You know, I'm with you. I can totally see Intel being like, no, nobody needs to know about this. We're good.
No take backs.
Brad says scratch off upgrades are a horrible idea. Not that I object to paying for the performance. Example, John Deere built engines for its equipment, and the only difference is the software and the controller as far as horsepower, torque, etc. But the assembly has a completely different part number. They would never offer to upgrade you for a price and leave you with a new part that was indistinguishable from the old part. Good to know about that. Should I ever buy a tractor? Yeah, our industry has already had plenty of cheating in the past. Video drivers optimized for benchmarks. I remember those. Drive capacities don't meet the advertised spec. Screen sizes that had to be regulated by the state of California before a 19-inch screen actually had 19 inches of viewable screen.
That's why we've got 24-inch class monitors right now.
Oh, man. Where do we draw the line, says Brad? Do we allow them to insert extra wait states to the memory, allow them to sell us unoptimized CPU microcode? How many – actually, they already do, dude. How many ways can they cripple a design to take advantage of less tech-savvy users? And selling these things through Best Buy, where buying a SATA cable is half the price of a new drive? Think they'd tell the average user that they'll barely notice the performance boost when browsing and doing email? It is hard to think of this as anything but a ripoff. The only way I'd go with this, if the operating system reported the model number straight from the CPU and the model number was changed when cores and cache were upgraded to make cheating incredibly difficult. Until then, keep this tech for the enterprise server market only. Again, another person that thinks this is a good idea for the server market. I wonder if Intel's offering this in the server market.
They aren't that I know of. I mean, this is like the first time. The funny thing is we're making a big deal about this and we're asking for feedback on stuff. And they offered this on one specific gateway computer, one specific model with one specific upgrade card, right? And I don't even know if it was all the Best Buy stores that offered it. And we just kind of, we've already gone and this is going to change the industry or whatever. But that's pretty funny. Good to see, though. So that, I mean, we got a lot of great feedback on that. I appreciate all the emails coming in. It's interesting to read all these different opinions back and forth either way. So definitely keep it coming on this topic or anything else. Let's see. We've got some more emails to get to, not related to scratch off CPU. So we're done with that topic. So I'm going to read this email from David. It's about sound cards, and it's a follow-up to 2 weeks ago. We had the headphone amp question that you answered very well. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to pass it off to you because you apparently have done some research on this product.
Maybe it owes me at least 2 hours of reading.
David says, I appreciate the great answer I got from the show for my headphone amp question. Have a follow-up for Patrick. You mentioned that you didn't like the Creative Cards much for music quality, or at least the X-Fi one that I have. So I'd like to know if you had any suggestions for a sound card that I could replace mine with. I was looking at this one as something that seems to be a good upgrade. The HT Omega Claro Halo PCI interface sound card with built-in hi-fi headphone amplifier. I'm guessing that if I get a sound card with a built-in amp, that I wouldn't need to get an external one that could kill two birds with one stone. But I'm completely open to suggestions if there's a better way to do things. Thanks again for the help.
I saw that name, and all I could think of was like one of those classic, weird, nobody's ever heard of it brands that print, you know, claims like audiophile superiority with misspelled words in the box. So I started doing research, right? Asus Zonar is a card that's gotten a lot of press, especially from Stereophile, as a audiophile quality card for your system. And I found a huge thread on head-fi.org. It's one of the best headphone cans listening, people who like to listen through headphones websites out there. And if you want to get really feral in terms of digital to analog converters, whether onboard, inside your PC or outside your PC, you know, hacks to iPods so that you take the signal directly from the logic board in the iPod before it gets to the operating amplifiers inside the iPod because you believe the op amps on the motherboard of the iPod or the logic board of the iPod are just not so good for the music. This right. is the kind of place you want to, and also it's also a great place to find out good advice for, like, you know, how do I build my own headphone amplifier? Which headphones are good? How do they sound? But it's like there's a real nerdy community here. It's a lot of fun. And they seem to really like these cards. And I found that that's a good sign to me, right? So the Claro Halo, yeah. It has a headphone amplifier built into the sound card. Very unusual. Of course, people have been modding it apparently with op amp upgrades. And I want to call them op amp upgrades. But basically they're already modifying the sound cards to get even better quality. But the general opinion on the boards that I saw, and I've only read about 10 pages out of the 30 odd pages. Just 10. Well, plus the htomega.com website for the Claro Halo, plus some of the reviews elsewhere. People are really enthusiastic about this board, and people seem to be very happy with the quality, the sound quality coming from the board. That said, you know, this is not a cheap card. Right, this is $250. Yeah, the Claro Halo XD PCI interface is $250, and the PCI is $200 and the PCI Express is $250. So this is not inexpensive. You know, for $150 right. you can get one of the Headroom Total Bithead amps, which is a really, really nice integrated DAC, and it's a DAC, it's a headphone amp. You can use it with your iPod. You can use it plugged into your PC or Mac. It's a really nice entry-level piece of audiophile gear. You could also buy the Zonar. The Asus Zonar is a pretty expensive card also. Would need a headphone amp to go with that one, but it's pretty top of the line. I would say, look, if you got a good set of headphones, you don't want to spend a lot of extra money, go for it. I'm going to say enough people like this card as is out of the box. I think you are safe to go with it. You're just, you know, missing the opportunity to get your feral nerd on and build your first Chumoy headphone amplifier and experiment with all different, you know, combinations of DACs and headphone amplifiers and headphones. And that just may be a little too hardware nerdish for you. But David, I think you are safe. It sounds interesting. Please, if you buy it, email us and let us know how you thought it sounded. Let me email and let you know what you think about this, David.
Let's make this big infinite loop of telling yourself how awesome that is.
This sounds so awesome.
I got another email here from T-O-O-2 about resolutions on displays. He said, I noticed that if I run anything off of the native resolution with my 24-inch monitor, it looks like absolute crap. So he's talking about if he has a 19 by 1080 screen, if he runs it at 1680 by 1050, he says it looks bad. He said, if I bought an ultra high res monitor, like a 30 inch, and wanted to run games in a lower resolution, such as 1920 by 1200, would that look terrible? Should I then settle for a normal 1080p monitor to avoid this issue? I also found one person saying that half the resolution is another native resolution. Is that true? The second part, I don't think that's the case at all. There's only one native resolution.
The native, your monitor is always going to look the best at the native resolution, period. Half resolution, poppycock.
Half resolution means that one pixel equals four pixels. So you'd get less jagged edges because you'd still have a bigger pixel on the monitor, I guess. Maybe. I don't know. To be honest with you, he says, go with a high-res 30-inch display. I use 30-inch displays all over our office here for testing purposes because we always need to be able to test that 2560 by 1600 resolution. But most of the time, I'm running these monitors like at desktop resolutions at 1920 by 1200, and they work fine. I don't notice any of the kind of glaring issues you see when you have a cheap monitor with running it out of its native resolution. I know it depends on the display, though. I think the Dell 3008 WFP has a built-in scaler unit that is used to up-convert and down-convert things. So it actually has HDMI and component input on the back of it. So it can take in, like, you could hook it up to your cable box or something like that. It acts just like a normal monitor, like a TV monitor. So it does scaling that way. And I don't know for sure if that also handles scaling down or if that's all handled by the graphics card. But I can tell you that for the Apple Cinema displays, the 30-inch Apple Cinema displays, and the Dell 3007 and 3008, I have had success running those at 1920 by 1200. My question would be, do you really want to spend $1,500 on a display and not run it at its topmost resolution? For gaming, I can understand, right? Because if your graphics card can't push 2560 by 1600 at high enough frame rate that you want to play at, then being able to run it at 19 by 12 with games is still going to be perfectly okay, I think. And especially when you're in a game and you're not looking at a white background, black text, looking at jagged edges and stuff. That it would be much, much less noticeable there. Honestly, it's been a while since I've taken a 24-inch display and not run it at its native resolution. So I'm not sure how things might have changed since however old this, your monitor is. So, I don't know if you had any different experience, but
I was going to say, would it letterbox at all, like a HDTV when you put a different signal through it? Or would it definitely scale to fill the entire panel?
So that's what it does is it, depending, actually the graphics drivers, like the NVIDIA drivers, I know, and I think the ATI drivers as well, will let you choose whether or not you want the graphics card to handle the scaling or if you want the monitor to handle the scaling. When the monitor does it, it tends to just blow everything up, right? So it just, it'll take it and it'll fill out the edges. But if you have the same aspect ratio, so 19 by 12 is the same aspect ratio as 25 by 16.
Right.
So you don't get any artifacting or anything like that. So that's the key, is to keep the aspect ratio the same, and you might have a better experience. So, before you go buy something new, on your 24-inch monitor, if this is a 19 by 12 display, find out what aspect ratio that is and make sure that, like, if you're running it at 1680 by 1050, that may be the next step down that's of the same aspect ratio. Try that out and see if you see anything different. I mean, if you're running at 1024 by 768 for some unknown ungodly reason, then yes, you're going to see ugliness on the screen. For sure.
Or just you can shrink it down to a little box surrounded by a lot of black inside of the screen.
Yes.
I think is one that probably also is worth experimenting with settings inside the drivers. Mm-hmm. And as always, make sure you have the latest graphics drivers loaded on your card. Dude, you're going to have to answer Ken's question about SLI scaling.
Okay.
I have an EVGA N468i SLI motherboard running a Core 2 Duo at 3.6 gigahertz with an NVIDIA GTX 460 video card with 1 gigabyte of RAM. I'm considering adding in another GTX 460 to run in SLI mode. My first question is, does SLI scale as well in older motherboards as it does in modern motherboards? And is this processor fast enough to make it worthwhile adding another GTX 460? And I might add in a third question, would it make more sense to just buy one new graphics card that will run faster than two GTX 460s in SLI mode?
So actually, the GTX 460 is unique. If you have a pair of those, they scale very well in SLI, and they actually outperform a GTX 480, which is more expensive than the pair of 460s.
Good news, Ken. So
you're getting more performance, less money, which is always good. And actually, I think they use a little bit more power, but that's inconsequential for most people. And he's talking about an EVGA 680i motherboard, so it's a little bit older. Not really old, but it's the two generations, I guess, of CPU architecture back. I don't think you're going to have any problems with scaling on that chipset. The PCI Express performance hasn't really changed. If anything, actually, PCI Express performance might be better in the older generations of motherboards because they were actually chipset-based PCI Express as opposed to PCI Express coming out of the CPU directly. So I don't think you should have any problem running a second 460 on this platform. I think your Core 2 Duo at 3.6 gigahertz is going to be fast enough to handle any of the extra CPU overhead required for SLI without too much of a problem. So I would definitely go that route. I think that's a good thing to do. The 460s are great cards, and if you want looking for more power, doubling that up is easy to do. We've talked about on previous shows how well SLI scales this generation. You know, seeing 75 to 90% SLI scaling is really awesome and a good investment for your money. So,
yep. For another GPU question.
Yeah, let's do that. We've got one from Raymond who asks, we are at the end of September, the last day, in fact, and looking for another video card to be installed in a Crossfire configuration. Basically, ATI has the 5000 series of cards out for a while. Should I wait until November? Obviously, he was listening at the beginning of our show. Should I wait until November when AMD ATI introduced the 6000 series of cards? He's heard the specs will be improved over 5000 series. Need your professional advice when the new video cards will be available to us consumers via Newegg and all the normal guys. We kind of answered this at the beginning, so I'll say we don't really know except that it will be sometime in November. I also don't know if he's interested in a 5700 equivalent or a 5800 equivalent, like what his price range is. It sounds like the 6700 series, the kind of the mid-range in performance graphic area. They always use these weird acronyms, mid-range performance, enthusiast performance. Those will be out first before like the 6800 series will be. So you might have to wait maybe even into December for those. At this point, I'm really just guessing. If you already have a 5000 series, I would just wait because he talks about adding a second card for Crossfire. Either way, actually, I would wait. If you have a 5000 today, wait for the 6000s to come out. And if you're impressed by their performance and price, then you can buy 6000. If you're not, I would expect the 5000 parts to come down in price. And then you can add in that second 5000 card, run it in Crossfire, and get your performance boost that way. That's worked out well.
No, it's just like one of those things. Like just wait. Trust us. Wait. It'll be better.
Yeah.
Jack, gaming performance drops. He's got a GeForce 275 NVIDIA Intel Core 2 Duo, 2 gigabytes of RAM. It's a two-year-old PC. It's doing great for Battlefield Company 2 at high to mid settings with low anti-aliasing. Problem is he's getting stuttering during gaming. It'll drop from 55 to 30 frames per second and will stutter, or should I call it lag, which suddenly has me thinking about hard drives and memory. I have 2 gigabytes of RAM on a single stick, and I was thinking about buying a Core 2 Quad. Do you think the Core 2 Quad will give me a boost in performance, or should I go with a Core i5 system? He's got $550. Man, I'm wondering if this – could Battlefield Company 2 – you know, be one of those things where it was interesting. One of the things that I got to talk to Lloyd Case on Techzilla about was at Intel Developer Forum, Intel being like, you know what? solid state drives, improve gaming performance because the levels are so huge and decision trees are so complicated in video games that it doesn't necessarily A, make the right decision to preload the correct information. So they're running into situations where games are stuttering because it can't move data into main system memory and then into the CPU and into the graphics card fast enough to keep things moving, which is a great time to get fragged and headshotted by everybody else who doesn't have that issue.
Right.
Because I'm wondering, right, because he's part of me is like wants to say like upgrade your RAM first, and but I haven't played Battlefield Bad Company 2 enough to know what's going on in terms of the gaming performance on that.
I honestly haven't either, but he says he has 2 gigs of RAM single stick. I would definitely put in 2 more gigs of RAM because the memory controllers are all dual channel controllers. If he's only using a single stick of memory, then he's not taking advantage of all the performance that he could in terms of the speed of the memory, and then doubling the capacity will also be a plus as well. That'd be the first thing I'd try. Also, when he says stuttering, he mentions it's dropping from 55 to 30, which, depending on how, if it's actually like pausing,
right,
or if it's just the frame rate's dropping. If the frame rate's dropping, I'm wondering if things are going on the screen, right? If a lot of stuff is happening, it's kind of normal to see frame rates come down when a lot more stuff is happening on the screen, in which case the GPU might be your bottleneck there. But I mean, dude, get another 2 gigs of RAM. You could probably pick it up for like $20 or something like that. You know, if this is DDR2 or DDR3 memory, I mean, it's probably DDR2 if it's a Core 2 Duo. I mean, That's your cheapest thing. Buy that, install it, and try that first. And then if it's like pausing the screen stuttering, maybe look at your storage options, like Patrick was saying. If it's the frame rate coming down and things, you know, like you can see like the frame rate dropping, but things are still processing and moving, it might be the GPU performance. So maybe you could try turning down the resolution, turning down the image quality settings a little bit more and see if that goes away. If it doesn't go away, then it's probably not your graphics card. So... looks like we got time for maybe a couple of more questions, and there's 2 interesting ones here. There's one here from Cliff we'll read about CPU affinity, and then one down here at the bottom about AFCI breakers that I thought you would like, Patrick. I'll read this one from Cliff first. He says he runs Microsoft Flight Simulator X with all the bells and whistles on, and it's a pig. My system is 2 years old, and I'm not going to upgrade my gaming machine for 6 months. At least he's on a schedule. I found a program called FSPS, Multi-Core Environment Advanced. They say it assigns different cores to different programs or functions to speed up the Flight Simulator X program. Is this possible, or is it snake oil? And I looked at this program, and it's an interesting little program that looks like it's kind of a better user interface for something that you can already do in the Task Manager. If you open up your Windows Task Manager and you look at all the process threads, not the applications, but the process threads. So they might not be named as nicely as you'd like. And you can find the ones that are associated with each individual program or game or whatever. And if you right-click on it or select it and go into the menu, you can set the CPU affinity, AFFINITY. I think I spelled that right. But what affinity does is it will allow you to tell the operating system what processing cores that thread is allowed to use. By default, it's open to all the processing threads, and the operating system is responsible for moving the threads around to whichever CPU it thinks should be using them and swapping memory or whatever it needs to do. It's useful. We use it for benchmarking and testing. If we want to test single-threaded performance, we might start an instance of Pavre, which is a raycasting benchmark that defaults to using all the threads, but then I can choose that process, select a single core, and it will only process that on a single core. So you could do that without this application, but this is kind of a nicer way to do it. It's not free, so that's why it's a good idea to ask these types of questions. And it says it supports all kinds of multi-core CPUs, and the idea here is apparently, I didn't know this, but Flight Simulator X or Flight Simulator 10 is apparently really, really piggish on CPU horsepower, but it's not very smart about how it divides that power between like a multi-core processor. And that's unfortunately the case with a lot of applications, is that they maybe they only planned on one or two threads, but now that you've got a six-core or a quad-core hyper-threaded part, you've got all these threads kind of sitting there doing nothing. And it sounds like this application attempts to let you spread that work out to multiple cores. I read some of the reviews. Some of them were positive. Some of them said it didn't really do anything. One of the guys that said it didn't do anything was on a dual-core processor, so I'm imagining it's not going to be a big advantage to anything there. But I would say continue to look at these reviews, because it looks like what they're doing is sound. What the theory behind what they're doing is sound. But having not that I'm not familiar with that specific application or in how it applies to multi-threaded, I'm hesitant to say yes or no for sure. But it seems interesting. And my guess is that you could use this tool not just for Flight Simulator X, but you could use this for any kind of computing environment where you want to maybe, you know, if you're doing multiple things and the processor, the operating system always seems to give preference to one over the other, and it's not the one you want to have preference. You know, maybe you're encoding something and watching Sling Player, and Sling Player always kinds of chokes when you're encoding something. You might be able to use this tool to easily say, well, when encoding starts, let it only use two threads, and let Sling Player make sure it has at least two or four threads to do whatever it needs to do. So it could be interesting for that.
I love playing around with assigning processors, because it most of the time in most applications it just doesn't do anything, but it's fun to feel like you're controlling the innards of the
you listen CPU. To me, operating system,
do what I tell you, even if it's the wrong thing. And yeah, I'm actually fascinated by the AFCI breaker problem. Mike says, I recently moved into a newer home that has arc fault current interrupter circuit breakers for the bedrooms, which is apparently a recent addition to the building code. It is. Basically, they're designed to detect a short arc, a non-intentional arc. Arcs can be intentional inside, like, the electrical motors, one inside your vacuum cleaner, which is why you don't run vacuum cleaners in explosive environments when the gas is leaking. Mike is running into something that a lot of people are having. When both his PC and his MacBook Pro sometimes trip the breaker randomly, and people are reporting this with MacBooks, with PCs, various other devices. He'll have his PC at full load and play for hours, and suddenly it'll trip and lose power. I've tried everything, replacing the power supply unit, replacing his uninterruptible power supply, his UPS. He's tried without a UPS. He's changed the breaker with one from another room, and eventually replaced his entire computer with a new i7 system. I did some research on the internet, and apparently a lot of people report having this problem, but there are a few solutions other than replacing the breaker with a non-AFCI breaker and breaking code. At the moment, the best I have is a UPS. It gives me enough time to run to the garage and flip the breaker back. Oh, while the siren song of a UPS howling goes off in the bathroom background. I hate that noise. Meep, meep.
It's worse if you're in the bathroom and that siren goes off too, so.
I've had that happen, and Mike says, not the greatest solution, running to the garage to flip the breaker in the middle of a StarCraft II multiplayer match.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah, so AFCI breakers are relatively new. They are not – circuit breakers are kind of like fuses. They're relatively Stone Age technology, and the fact that you have to work really hard to screw it up, or you have to get really unlucky buying one. I started searching around online for this, and – it's interesting to read some of the threads, and there are recalls on, about 700,000 Schneider Electric North America AFCIs coming from the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Hmm. There are a lot of people running into issues with them that seem to be supported by swapping out for a newer or different, because Mike's like, I swapped them, it didn't help. You may want to try swapping in one or having an electrician swap one in, because I always get a little paranoid. I'm great with playing around with 10,000 volts off of a you know what I mean, like you I love playing with high voltage electricity. There's nothing more fun than the transformer off of a neon sign, because you can create huge spark gaps with it. Right. I get really uptight about playing around. I do not recommend people playing around with these circuit breakers in their head. Replacing a socket is one thing in the wall. Mm-hmm. Anytime you get into the panel, I don't do that. I also rent, so if I, you know, there's a really good reason for me not to do it. Yeah. But I would do some more research, or I would research the specific brand and model of your AFCI breakers. I would see whether or not there is something newer available or from a different manufacturer. There are some reports online that some of them are less susceptible to this problem, but it's legit. There are a lot of people, especially MacBook owners, that are running into problems with their MacBook under normal use, not arcing, not blowing up, not trying to take out the house, causing this. This is interesting. I'd be curious if there's anybody out there who's a little closer to this or has solved the AFCI problem or is an electrician. Email us, Twitch at
Twitch.tv. Oh,
thank you.
You know what?
I was about to say Gmail. I'm like, that's not right.
That's not right. This actually happened to me in my house, house I live in right now. It was only built 5 years ago, and the AFCI breakers are required now. And the odd thing that happened to me, it was there was a specific power supply that did it. Unfortunately, it was the power supply that I bought four of for all of my test beds. I had already had to, now that I'm working out of the office, it's much less of a pain, but I'd already had to take, I was lucky, on the other side of a wall was another bedroom. The office, the other side of that wall was another bedroom that was on a different circuit. So I kind of like punched a hole in the wall and brought that outlet into the office as well. So I had two circuits coming in into the office, and that was nice. But I had that AFCI issue, and hopefully the Boone County Sheriff's not listening, but the only way I got past it was to switch out the breakers for non-AFCI. So if I ever sell the house, I have to put those back in. But what I kind of learned was the problem was that as these power supplies have gotten bigger and more powerful, that part of the startup process in the power supply is apparently similar to that arcing that the AFCI breakers are supposed to watch for.
There's basically a fast power ramp up, especially as you're spinning up hard drives. It's always amazing to watch sort of hard drives spin up and what that does to the power consumption. And graphics cards have to be vastly more power hungry than hard drives are at this point.
Yep. So it was interesting. I don't have an answer other than to say I did the same thing and I broke code instead. I guess now that I don't test it again, I'll have to remember to do that. And I too, when you were talking about not wanting to work in the breaker box, I have like a fear of electricity in general, of getting electrocuted regardless of where it's at. And I was like, the sweat was pouring down my forehead as I was like reaching to pull the breaker out and stuff. I would recommend having an electrician do it as well. Actually, that's why I had to do it. An electrician will not do it because of the code issue. So,
oh man, when I was 15 or 16, I was installing a attic fan at my dad's house. Because I kind of ended up with all the electrical work because I was pretty comfortable with it. Yeah. And completely unrelated, but while I was up there in the attic, we had some very temperamental transformers in the part of Pennsylvania where my dad lived. The main transformer for our neighborhood blew down the street. I was just upstairs. I hadn't actually connected to anything yet, but there's this gigantic popping sort of, you know, weird noise that comes that if you've ever heard a transformer blow, you kind of know what the noise is. And that noise happens and the electrical goes flat and the house goes dark. And I hear my dad bellowing my name and sprinting upstairs. And I'm like, I haven't touched anything yet.
Nice.
You know, and later on, you know, that was the same transformer that blew a few months later again, and you watch the beautiful blue oil burning on the top of the telephone pole. It's pretty awesome. But being afraid of electricity is a perfectly rational and healthy thing to do.
I agree. It's kept me alive for 28 years. So, okay, that's going to wrap up the show for this week. We live on your questions. We'd love for you guys to send them in. They don't have to be specific computer hardware questions. They could be things about like interesting things like the AFCI issue or your headphone amps questions and those types of things. Things that are related to computers and technology. We field everything. We can't always answer, but we field everything. And that email address again is twitch@twit.tv. That goes to both Patrick and I. And that's all the goodies. Let's see. You can find me, PC Perspective, PCPER.com at Ryan Shrout on Twitter, and Patrick Norton, you are located at multiple spots.
Patrick Norton on Twitter. That was easy. Techzilla is the show I do with Veronica Belmont every week. We get our geek on with software and hardware and things that go bump in the night. And HD Nation with Robert Herron. We do home theater technology and HD content. HDNation.tv and Techzilla.com.
Very cool. So,
cool.
All right, well, we will see everybody next week. We record the show live every Thursday at, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern time, live.twit.tv, or you can obviously subscribe to us at twit.tv/Twitch, iTunes, Zoom Marketplace, any of those places. Look for Twitch, TWICH, and that will be where you'll find us. So thanks again, and we will talk to you next week.